Milwaukee's future is already here, at least as our designers see it. But the shimmering landmarks of the present emerge from a most turbulent recent past. I'm John Goerta. This time we close the making of Milwaukee with the rise of the modern city. How today's Milwaukee was shaped by depression and war, prosperity and protest, riot, recession, and rebirth.
Production of The Making of Milwaukee is made possible with grants from Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Halbert and Alice Kadish Fund, Paddock Fund, Lidke Smith Fund, Otto Borchard Family Fund, Catherine and Walter Lindsay Fund, Lined and Harry Bradley Foundation, Kepin Gerlach Foundation, Faye Macbeth Foundation, Northwestern Mutual Foundation, David and Julia Eline Charitable Foundation, We Energies, Joseph and Vera Zilber Foundation, Polybill Foundation, Douglas and Eleanor Seaman Trust, C.G. Schmidt, and by the MPTV Friends.
No one saw it coming. When the stock market crashed in October 1929, no one in Milwaukee dreamed that the storm would reach their city. Work was plentiful. Wages were good. "We haven't noticed any drop in business," said industrialist Herman Falk. Even in 1930, the Milwaukee Journal bragged that the local market was immune from peaks and panics. They were wrong, of course. The storm finally broke over Milwaukee in 1931, and its impact was horrifyingly complete. Jobs vanished overnight. By 1933, unemployment topped 40%, and more than half the city's property taxes went unpaid. An eerie calm followed the downpour, a period of economic paralysis that no one alive had ever seen before. Workers who had lost their jobs lost their savings, and then lost their homes. Just as soon as the economy began to move again, there were more dark clouds on the horizon, the clouds of World War II. A second downpour started on December 7, 1941. In the months following Pearl Harbor, Milwaukee became a major center of defense production. Some war workers put in 10-hour days, 7 days a week, for the next 4 years.
That was Milwaukee's weather from 1930 to 1945, a series of storm fronts that kept everyone off balance for 15 long years. The entire nation was blown from a monetary crisis to a military crisis without a moment to breathe in between. By the time the clouds finally lifted, life had changed forever.
The human costs of the Depression years were incalculable. Those 15 years seemed much longer than they were. The human suffering appeared to be endless. Thousands of families who had worked their way up into the middle class sank back into poverty. In Estabrook Park, the newly homeless built a makeshift settlement known as a Hooverville, after President Herbert Hoover. Hungry and discouraged, thousands more turned to the government for help. Milwaukee County's outdoor relief program supplied bulk food, cheap coal, and rent vouchers to the destitute. As the Depression deepened, one meatball casseroles were a staple in many households. Clothes and shoes were worn until they were literally worn out. Furloughed workers often moved in with relatives, and it wasn't unusual for three or four families to share a single flat. As tax revenue plummeted, local government faced a crisis. Thrifty librarians created books by clipping serialized novels from popular magazines. There was even talk of slaughtering some of the heavy eaters in the Washington Park Zoo. Mayor Dan Hone was not about to see elephant steaks on local soup kitchen menus. A business may quit, he said. Your city can't. Hone realigned city government from top to bottom, economizing without eliminating vital services. The results were stellar. Milwaukee won more than a dozen awards in the 1930s as the safest, healthiest city in America. The community was periodically barred from the health contest just to give other cities a chance. Milwaukee chipped away at its debt and even began to set aside money for capital improvements. In 1936, Dan Hone became one of the few American mayors ever to appear on the cover of Time. Daniel Webster Hone, wrote the magazine, remains one of the nation's ablest public servants. And under him, Milwaukee has become perhaps the best governed city in the U.S. But magazine covers couldn't end the hard times. The Depression was clearly a national emergency that required national action. Enter Franklin D. Roosevelt. Elected in 1932, the new president promptly offered a New Deal to get America moving again. Work relief was the New Deal's centerpiece. Roosevelt launched a barrage of programs to re-employ the unemployed. The Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Progress Administration, and numerous others. They were known by their initials, the CCC, the WPA, the NYA, FERA, and the CWA. Some critics derided the programs as alphabet soup, but no one could deny they were nourishing. The New Deal put tens of thousands to work on projects that were large-scale, long-term, and largely unskilled. That meant parks, more often than not, and Milwaukee was ideally positioned. The county had huge tracts of green space and shelves full of plans for its development. When federal funds became available, Milwaukee put 4,000 men to work on 2 days' notice. The city and county systems were combined under county auspices for greater efficiency, and the workforce soon doubled. Some relief crews developed neighborhood parks on tax-delinquent land that had reverted to the city. Others laid out parkways along the county's watercourses, following Charles Whitnell's master plan to the letter. Tons of dolomite from the county's own quarry were used for bridges and walls on the parkways. Still other crews built regional parks from the ground up. The county's largest green space was, and is, the aptly named Whitnell Park, a square mile of raw land that became a metropolitan showplace. Whitnell Park is still the county's garden spot. Although parks received the greatest attention, the New Deal also funded a number of big-ticket projects, from the essential to the experimental. They included a water purification plant on the lakefront, Park Lawn, a low-income housing project on the northwest side, and, boldest of all, the village of Greendale. The community came to life on 5 square miles of land southwest of Milwaukee. Relief crews turned it into a planned community for working-class families. With curving streets, a picturesque downtown, and ample green space. Completed in 1938, Greendale was similar to Greenbelt towns in Ohio and Maryland. The notion behind all three was the same. Surround workers with nature, and they will all become better citizens. Generations later, the original village is still a much admired example of urban planning. Work relief wasn't just for those who wore blue collars. WPA programs put people to work in the arts, crafts, and even local history. Their efforts had enduring value. In ways both large and small, the work of the 1930s is still with us today.
The New Deal helped the unemployed, but it also changed the lives of the slim majority who kept their jobs. Labor finally won the right to organize and bargain collectively, and unions entered their golden age. After years of wage cuts and layoffs, workers felt powerless. They were quick to form labor unions, and employers were just as quick to resist. The result was an epidemic of strikes.
Milwaukee experienced 107 industrial disputes in 1934 alone, and they involved 27,000 workers in plants ranging from steel foundries to sausage factories. The most serious strike was against the electric company. Pro-labor demonstrators filled the streets, and the dispute ended with a union victory only after one protester had been fatally electrocuted. Other conflicts were more comic than tragic. As strike fever mounted, the students of Dover Street School picketed for shorter days and longer recesses. One sign declared that the school was unfair to students. Teachers urged them to come back to class and learn how to spell. As management and labor worked out their differences, conditions gradually improved. Workers won higher wages, paid vacations, and, at long last, the 8-hour day. The result, when good times returned, was that the working class entered the middle class. There were other bright spots amid the general gloom of the Depression. Prohibition ended in 1933. Local breweries surged back into production, and the spigots ran wide open. Milwaukee's taverns. Baseball entered a golden age. Sandlot games drew as many as 20,000 entertainment-starved fans to the diamond at Mitchell Park. Those with a little cash to spare could watch the minor league Milwaukee Brewers play at Borchert Field, a Northside landmark shoehorned into a single city block. Home run balls occasionally sailed through the dining room windows across the street. Perhaps the biggest morale booster of the 30s was the Midsummer Festival, a free lakefront celebration that ran from 1933 to 1941. Nearly a million people turned out each year for the pageants, concerts, displays, and, of course, beer. Mayor Dan Hone, the Midsummer Festival's guiding spirit, described the lakefront crowds as one large happy family playing together as we work together for the greater glory of the city we all love. Today, in the same location, Summerfest overflows with the same spirit of celebration. Dan Hone himself had less to celebrate as the 1930s wore on. An economic relapse in 1938 wiped out any hopes that the Depression was ending. And a formidable opponent emerged in the 1940 mayoral race, Carl Zeidler. The challenger was an assistant city attorney with no discernible ideology. But Zeidler was a stirring speaker and a gifted singer with energy to spare. He gave Milwaukee its first modern political campaign. Voters picked the challenger in 1940. After 24 years, the Hone era came to an end, and with it passed the high tide of municipal socialism in America. Carl Zeidler acknowledged Hone's accomplishments, but he was looking ahead. At his inauguration, the new mayor declared, "Hats off to the past, coats off to the future." But Zeidler was soon overwhelmed by events beyond the control of any mayor. Nazi Germany had invaded Poland in 1939, barely 6 months before his election, and the clouds of World War II were spreading quickly to America. The storm broke in 1941. With the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the United States pitched headlong into the conflict. Milwaukee was once again in crisis mode. Thousands of young men and women entered the military without waiting for the draft, including Carl Zeidler himself. The mayor went off to sea in 1942, taking charge of the gunnery crew aboard a merchant vessel. "My life is not my own," he explained. "It belongs to my country." 8 months later, Zeidler's ship went down with all hands in the South Atlantic, the victim of a German U-boat attack. A promising career came to an untimely end. The losses mounted, but Milwaukeeans had little time to grieve. As a major industrial center, the city played a pivotal role in President Roosevelt's arsenal of democracy. When America entered the war, the idleness of the Depression years soon became a distant memory. Faced with a need to double, triple, and quadruple their outputs, local industries put on additions as fast as they could and filled them with new machinery. Most Milwaukee industries concentrated on their standard products. Defense plants around the country relied on Harnischweger cranes, Cutler Hammer electrical controls, and Kearney and Trecker machine tools. Harley-Davidson motorcycles provided quick and efficient transport behind the front lines. Caring construction machinery made new military bases possible. Some old products found new uses. Allen Bradley resistors became prime components in walkie-talkies and radar sets. Briggs & Stratton ignition systems were standard equipment on Allied warplanes. Falk made gear systems for warships and landing craft. Still other companies applied their standard technologies to military products. Hosiery firms made parachute silk. Pabst introduced a camouflaged beer can. A.O. Smith made 80% of America's bomb casings. The region's biggest defense contractor by far was Allis Chalmers. Nearly 20,000 people worked for the company at flood tide, enough to fill a small city. They turned out an unmatched variety of products, but the company's most important contribution was its work on the atomic bomb. Allis Chalmers produced more nuclear equipment than any company in America.
Part of the Holly Road plant behind me here was dedicated to work on the bomb that leveled Hiroshima. It was a place of extraordinary secrecy. Military guards were on duty 24 hours a day, and workers were cautioned not to discuss the project with anyone, not their families, not their friends, not even each other.
All of Milwaukee's defense plants faced a chronic shortage of workers. Thousands of rural Wisconsinites poured into the city, and African Americans walked through doors that had been closed for years. In 1943, the Urban League observed, "Today there is hardly a Negro man in Milwaukee who is physically able and willing to work who is not employed." Women were equally indispensable. By the end of 1943, they held more than a quarter of Milwaukee County's industrial jobs. Rosie the Riveter had found her niche. Many women thrived in their new positions. "I can do as much work as any man," said Teresa Langolf, a welder at Chain Belt, "and I can do it just as well or better." For all Milwaukee's war workers, men and women, black and white, the hours were long and vacations non-existent. Everything moved to the rhythm of the war effort. Catholic churches offered midnight masses on Saturday for workers who had to be on the job Sunday morning. The Milwaukee Brewers scheduled early morning games for the convenience of workers coming off the night shift. Borchard Field's ushers dressed in pajamas and passed out cereal and donuts. When Detroit stopped making cars, Americans were forced to either walk or take the trolley. Mass transit ridership in Milwaukee reached an all-time high in 1944, almost 10 times the current level. Gasoline rationing kept drivers close to home, and food rationing limited their diet. Meat was often in especially short supply. Peanut butter and jelly replaced ham and cheese in thousands of lunch pails. No one complained. Patriotism, in fact, remained at a high pitch. Most families invested their newly swollen paychecks in war bonds. Milwaukee's youngsters collected scrap metal and paper for the war effort. Victory gardens sprouted on vacant land in every neighborhood, conserving the nation's food supplies for military use. No one complained, but Milwaukeeans were starved for diversions of any kind. One of the most memorable involved a duck. In April 1945, a mallard laid a clutch of eggs on a piling next to the Wisconsin Avenue Bridge. Gertie the Duck, a reporter named her, and she became an overnight celebrity. Newspapers breathlessly reported every twist in her story, down to its happy ending in the peaceful waters of the Juneau Park Lagoon. Gertie's story inspired a children's book that was widely read in America and translated into Spanish and French. Gertie was a welcome diversion, but nothing short of victory would bring Milwaukee's worries to an end. The long-awaited news finally came on August 14, 1945. Japan had surrendered. Slowly at first, people headed to the heart of Milwaukee. Long before midnight, downtown was packed with jubilant crowds celebrating the end of their long national ordeal.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bob Johnson in front of the Riverside Theater in downtown Milwaukee. This is the kind of day you wait 3.5 years for, and after it finally comes, you hope to high heaven you're never going to have to wait for another one like it. What is your name?
Esther Adair.
What do you think of all this celebration?
Oh, I'm so happy. This is the happiest day in 3 years. My husband is over in Guam, and I expect he'll be home sooner than I expected.
Well, when your husband comes back, he'll return to a very lovely wife. Thanks an awful lot. Oh, the crowds have increased. As I look west up Wisconsin Avenue, I see more people than I ever saw before in my life in one single aggregation. Here's a lady standing beside me in a pretty yellow coat. This is WISN, madam. Would you tell us your name?
Mrs. Lasnik.
What do you think of this great celebration?
Well, it's a sight that I've never witnessed in my life. So exciting, I really don't know what to say.
Well, it's a rather beautiful sight, isn't it?
It's beautiful, I'll say.
And yet we all hope that we don't have to go through a sight like this for the same reason again.
Hope not. Never again.
As you see all these people milling up and down the street, it's just a mass, a sea of humanity. I never saw so many people happy in my life. What is your name, young lady?
Pat.
Pat, where are you? Patsy Lou? Isn't that a pretty name? You know what all this noise is for and all these people are shouting about?
Because the war is over.
That's right.
And bring home my daddy.
Oh, swell. Isn't that fine? How long has your daddy been in there?
Milwaukeeans knew what they had done. Roughly 70,000 citizens went off to war. Nearly three times that many stayed home to keep the defense plants humming. Their work was absolutely crucial. Without the guns and gears, the boots and bombs produced on the home front, Allied soldiers would have had to fight with their bare hands. No less than the troops at the front lines, it was the workers who won the war.
Well, all we can say is it's a happy day here in Milwaukee. It's VJ Day, oh, happy day.
The end of the war meant the end of perhaps the most abnormal 15 years in our nation's history. Between 1930 and 1945, Milwaukee, with the rest of America, moved from the worries of the Depression to the worries of war without a moment's pause in between. By 1945, people were tired of the extremes. Years of privation, years of pressure, had left them starved for a life they recognized as normal. They were determined to find it, and the result was an explosion that still echoes today.
America's veterans returned to a hero's welcome and high hopes that the worst was finally over. After 15 years of depression and war, their aspirations had been strained to the breaking point. With the coming of peacetime, the dam burst wide open, releasing a torrent of dreams deferred and hopes postponed. The old order was washed away. And in its place rose, in some respects, a new America.
My father never talked much about the war. Not until he was in his 80s did he tell us many stories about his time on Iwo Jima. He was looking ahead after the horrors of World War II, not to the troubled past. His entire generation was determined to build a new world. One that would make up for all the years of worry and want, struggle and sacrifice. The result was a series of explosions that rattled the entire nation. A baby boom, a housing boom, a suburban boom, and a record-shattering economic boom. Milwaukee, like America, was transformed. My family, like so many others, entered a new dimension.
Babies came first. Hard times and wartime had been no time to start a family. Milwaukee's birth rate fell to its historic low during the Depression and rebounded only slightly during the war. A baby boom began 9 months after the Allied victory and continued for nearly 20 years. The baby boom sparked an intense housing boom. 15 years of Depression and war had brought all development to a halt. Returning veterans faced the most desperate housing shortage since pioneer days. Hundreds of families were forced to live in temporary homes, some in trailers on the lakefront, others in prefabricated houses on county parkland. It was not until the mid-1950s that supply finally caught up with demand. There was nothing especially elegant about the houses that appeared. The most common were Cape Cods, many with doghouse dormers, ranch houses, and plain brick apartment buildings. Elegant or not, Milwaukee's post-war homes met an urgent need for shelter, and they met it with amazing speed. By 1960, the county's housing stock had increased by more than a third.
My own family fit the post-war patterns to a T. My mother and father met and married during the war. She was a Red Cross worker on an Army base where he was stationed. When my father returned from the Pacific, he moved into his old room above the family hardware store. My mother and sister stayed with an aunt. In 1946, my parents bought their first home, this prefab Cape Cod on South 34th Street. It cost a total of $5,600, lot included. I was born here a year later, and two more sons followed. In 1955, as the kids got bigger and the house got smaller, my parents moved a few miles southwest to this ranch home in Hales Corners. The local grade school was soon overwhelmed. Classes mushroomed to alarming sizes, and new additions couldn't be built fast enough. The basic outline of my family story was repeated literally millions of times in this block, throughout Milwaukee, and across the nation.
Those millions of families had much in common, including a taste for the latest post-war conveniences. Between 1946 and 1965, Milwaukee's electric power consumption per household more than tripled. The most popular appliance was something new, the television. Milwaukee's first station, WTMJ-TV, signed on at the end of 1947. There were only 1,000 sets in the area at the time. 10 years later, more than 97% of local households owned one. Television programs offered a high-gloss reflection of what life was supposed to be like in the 50s. Father knew best, Mom was in the kitchen, and we left it to Beaver. Real life went on without a laugh track, of course. But television lifted up new cultural icons that had enormous appeal. The most powerful icon in post-war America was the automobile. The number of cars in Milwaukee County nearly doubled in the first post-war decade. It was the automobile, of course, that made Milwaukee's outward expansion possible. It also spawned an entirely new form of commerce, the shopping center. Southgate was Milwaukee's first. When it opened in 1951, nearly 60,000 people flocked to South 27th Street, snarling traffic for hours. The automobile left a more pervasive mark on the landscape. As the number of cars in Milwaukee multiplied, streets built for horses and trolleys were overwhelmed. The solution to gridlock, everyone agreed, was expressways. Milwaukee adopted its first freeway plan in 1946. And construction began 6 years later. The first segment of Interstate 94 opened in Waukesha County in 1958. Governor Vernon Thompson did the honors, with a little help from Miss Concrete and Miss Blacktop. As the post-war boom gathered steam, freeway construction was practically continuous. And what fueled Milwaukee's continuing boom? What paid for all the cars and TV sets and freeways? Industrial prosperity. As pent-up consumer demand sought its outlet, local factories roared from defense work to peacetime production without missing a beat. Millions of automobiles rode on A.O. Smith frames. Millions of consumers used electricity generated by Alice Chalmers turbines. Industries everywhere relied on coal and metals mined by Bucyrus Erie shovels. Aerospace firms turned to the Ladish Company for high-quality forging. And there were still old standbys, like beer. Breweries accounted for only 2% of the area's employment in 1948, but returning servicemen showed a powerful thirst for Milwaukee-made suds. It took just 6 years for the county's industrial output to double after the war. Milwaukee and America seemed to be soaring ever upward in a spiral of self-generating prosperity. The new age called for new leaders. Mayor John Bone, who succeeded the charismatic Carl Zeidler, ended his caretaker administration in 1948 when he was 80 years old. Bone's successor was Frank Zeidler, Carl's younger brother. Earnest, intellectual, and idealistic, Zeidler emerged from a crowded field to win the city's top job in 1948. And he stayed in office until 1960.
The functions of a mayor of any large city in America are very heavy and very numerous. They can be divided into three different categories. In the first category, the mayor is the chief administrative officer of the city. In the second capacity, the mayor is the principal greeter and the chief ceremonial officer of the community. In his third category, he must be a civic leader, sometimes even a political leader, in order to get across the proper kind of a program for the development and progress of the city.
Frank Zeidler was a socialist in the tradition of Dan Hone and Victor Berger. The party itself was no longer a political force. New Deal Democrats had captured its base of support. But Zeidler's socialist beliefs were his guiding star. "We participate in local government," he once said, "in order that by our participation there may emerge nobler beings with enlarged concepts of liberty, truth, justice, cooperation, peace, and righteousness." Those ideals breathed new life into Milwaukee's tradition of municipal enterprise. One expression of that tradition was an aggressive annexation campaign. Convinced that Milwaukee had to grow or die in the post-war era, Zeidler's team doubled the city's land area in 12 short years. Annexation was always voluntary, but city water and city services were hard to resist. Such growth was practically unheard of among the nation's older cities. As her sisters stagnated, Milwaukee absorbed scores of subdivisions that were suburban in everything but name, and made room for new industries to grow and old ones to relocate. Much of Milwaukee's new territory was farmland. Some visitors are amazed to find that there are still cornfields inside the city limits in the 21st century. Although the city was growing fast, its suburbs were growing even faster. It had taken a half century for Milwaukee's first 11 suburbs to form. The next eight appeared in a single burst between 1950 and 1957. As would-be suburbs tried to organize, Milwaukee continued to take in land, often block by block and acre by acre. The battle lines were frozen in 1957, when the city of Greenfield became Milwaukee's last neighbor to incorporate.
The result was a hopelessly tangled borderline. To this day, there are curbs and sidewalks here on the Milwaukee side, but not in Greenfield. Some families actually eat in one community and sleep in the other. But the incorporation of Greenfield had broader significance. It completed what Frank Zeidler called the iron ring of suburbs encircling the city. The Milwaukee Journal described the last link in that ring as a minor tragedy.
The whole picture is indeed tragic in the sense that it is frustrating, inefficient, expensive, and unintelligent. Every last acre of Milwaukee County is now incorporated in a jumble of 10 cities and 9 villages, all being one community, really.
With the political fragmentation of Milwaukee County complete, the suburban wave surged outward to neighboring counties. Waukesha County's growth was especially dramatic. Once a national center of dairy farming, Waukesha became better known for housing developments than Holsteins, and the rural way of life faded with the sunset over the western hills. Milwaukee's lifeblood seemed to be draining away to the edges after World War II. The Depression and war had stopped downtown development in its tracks, and there were few signs of new activity when peacetime returned. A correspondent for The New Yorker took a jaundiced look at the heart of the city.
No new large office building has been put up in downtown Milwaukee in more than 20 years. And the skyline, if approached from Lake Michigan, gives the impression of a city that had its picture taken around 1920 and liked the results so much that it decided to leave matters alone.
New buildings began ever so slowly to erase that impression. The arena doubled Milwaukee's convention space and provided room for professional indoor sports. In 1957, the War Memorial Center gave Milwaukee its first major piece of modern architecture, a soaring design by Eero Saarinen. The structure's best-known tenant was the Milwaukee Art Center. The Marine Bank, Milwaukee's oldest financial institution, built another modernist icon on the downtown riverfront a few years later. And Milwaukee's Greeks moved into their Frank Lloyd Wright-designed home in Wauwatosa. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee rose from the foundation of the Old State Teachers College in 1956. Enrollment quickly surged to 25,000. These and other new landmarks were all welcome additions to the Milwaukee scene. They marked a community whose star was on the rise. But one new structure stood alone as a symbol of Milwaukee's big league aspirations. County Stadium. Building it was a staggering leap of faith for a community that no one has ever mistaken for impetuous. Milwaukee put up a major league ballpark without the slightest assurance that a team was available. Build it, said civic leaders, and they will come. Those leaders were right. In 1953, the Boston Braves, parent team of the minor league Brewers, became the Milwaukee Braves. Fan support verged on the fanatical. Thousands showed up just to watch infield practice. The Braves set a National League attendance record in their first season. The story just kept getting better. In 1957, the Braves won the pennant and faced the New York Yankees in the World Series. When a Yankee offhandedly described local fans as Bush League, the series became a contest between big city vice and small city virtue, between might and right. It took a full seven games, but right prevailed. The streets of downtown Milwaukee overflowed in a spontaneous outpouring of joy.
County Stadium is just a memory today. It was torn down to make way for Miller Park, and this Little League field now fills the site. But what happened here capped a remarkable period in Milwaukee's history. In the 15 years following World War II, Milwaukee entered the big leagues and then conquered them. The city's population reached an all-time high in 1960, rising to 11th place in the country. New families were formed, new landmarks emerged, and the economy soared to new heights of prosperity. For a few years on either side of 1960, Milwaukee was at a peak of civic self-confidence. Before long, however, it would be harder and harder to ignore the effects of gravity.
What about those who have been here for some time in these dirty, rotten houses that are rat infested with windows broken, standing there vacant? What about those now? Like, the people here are suffering now. What do you want to do about it now? What are you going to do about it now?
I am not in a position to answer that question.
Why?
The 1960s were a rough decade for America's cities. Book after book, study after study, pronounced them a dying breed, weighed down by problems no one could solve. There were enough of these bleak chronicles to fill a small library, and they led readers to believe that American cities had entered a new dark age.
Well, not exactly. Urban America did face a crisis rooted in issues of poverty and race. Milwaukee, a newcomer to the big leagues, discovered that she had big league problems as well. But they were by no means the whole story. The years after 1960 were, as usual, a mixture of darkness and light.
The period began with a changing of the political guard. When Mayor Frank Zeidler stepped down in 1960, Henry Meyer won the race to succeed him. Meyer was a leader of the state's resurgent Democratic Party, and he became one of the most paradoxical figures in Milwaukee's political history. The new mayor was a flamboyant orator, a skilled administrator, and a tireless advocate for the city he loved, particularly when seeking state and federal funds.
We feel that the incumbent responsibility for aid and help and the alleviation of these problems rests on the shoulders of the governor of the state of Wisconsin, our governor.
Meyer was also a notoriously thin-skinned politician with a penchant for bitter feuds. His bottomless scorn for the Milwaukee Journal lasted until his death. But Henry Meyer's defining trait was his deep affinity for the status quo. He kept the city on an even keel, and voters rewarded him with 28 consecutive years in office, one of the longest runs in American history. After a few terms, mayor and Meyer were practically synonymous. In 1960, the same year Mayor Meyer was elected, John Doyne became Milwaukee's first county executive. County government had become, over the decades, a sprawling empire of barely related domains. Courts and corrections, hospitals and airports, golf courses and expressways, the park system and the welfare system. It became apparent that this conglomeration of services was simply too complex to be managed by a board of part-time supervisors. As the first executive, John Doyne brought new vigor and visibility to county government during his 16 years in office, a pattern continued by Bill O'Donnell for the next 12. Both Doyne and O'Donnell were proud Irishmen with close ties to the Merrill Park neighborhood. The county launched several big-ticket projects in the 60s that reflected Milwaukee's continuing optimism. The new zoo was among the first in America to showcase animals in habitat enclosures without bars or cages. The Mitchell Park domes served as a sort of zoo for plants, with arid, tropical, and temperate displays that took visitors around the botanical globe. The new public museum, which became a county facility in 1976, earned national fame as an interpreter of natural and cultural history. The Performing Arts Center provided an elegant new home for Milwaukee's symphony, theater, and ballet companies. It became the focal point of a cultural rebirth. Freeway construction, another county responsibility, continued at a breakneck pace. In 1968, the linchpin of the entire system was completed, the Marquette Interchange. 3.5 miles of concrete spaghetti piled in a mound that was visible from outer space. These landmarks of the 1960s were all signs of what most still considered forward progress. But there was a growing awareness that some things had been lost in the brave new world of the post-war years. The automobile had pushed older forms of transport to extinction. The last streetcar ran in 1958. Neighborhood shopping districts had become an endangered species. Central Milwaukee looked decidedly dingy. Anything old was temporarily out of fashion, and the city's built heritage was in peril. Photographer Lyle Oberweis chronicled this vanishing landscape. His images offer an eerie reflection of a lost Milwaukee. Urban renewal, a government program some critics blasted as urban removal, practically erased old neighborhoods like the Third Ward and the Lower East Side. Milwaukee's redevelopment program was minuscule in comparison with other cities. The freeway system claimed 10 times more land than urban renewal, particularly in the heart of town. Some cherished landmarks were among the casualties, including Our Lady of Pompeii, the spiritual home of the city's Sicilians. The results were obvious. By the mid-1960s, central Milwaukee had lost much of its mass. Other losses were beyond human control. Majestic elm trees had once turned the city streets into green cathedrals. Dutch elm disease brought those cathedrals crashing to the ground. The epidemic reached its peak in 1967, when 19,000 trees were destroyed. Another uninvited guest fouled the city's beaches. Alewives, an ocean fish that came west through the St. Lawrence Seaway, died off by the thousands in the 1960s. News from the world of sports caused an even greater stink. In 1965, the owners of the Milwaukee Braves moved their team to Atlanta. Local fans were outraged.
Milwaukee and her sister cities soon faced problems involving much more than blight and baseball. It became obvious that some people had been left behind by the runaway prosperity of the 50s. More often than not, they were people of color, especially African Americans.
Milwaukee was a latecomer in matters of race. Although the African American community was planted well before the Civil War, blacks were a relatively minor minority. Barely 2% of Milwaukee's population as late as 1945. The reason was Chicago. The Windy City had absorbed the major share of Southern blacks seeking work in the urban north. Milwaukee, lying squarely in Chicago's shadow, generally ranked last among large cities in its percentage of African Americans. That changed forever after World War II. As a booming economy attracted newcomers, the number of African Americans soared from 22,000 in 1950 to 105,000 in 1970. And from 3% of the city's population to 15%. Not since the Poles in the late 1800s, and the Germans even earlier, had there been such a huge influx of a single ethnic group. Like their predecessors, the African Americans reshaped the face of Milwaukee, and they did so with history-making speed. This distinctive community developed a distinctive set of institutions. As always, churches were symbols of hope and anchors of identity, and their numbers multiplied. Northside business leaders joined forces to strengthen the local economy. And athletic teams at North Division High School were cheered with wild enthusiasm. Building on traditions that spanned the generations, Milwaukee's African Americans developed a rich and satisfying communal life. Too often, however, they experienced both poverty and prejudice. Nearly every new arrival settled in a section of the North Side known as the Inner Core. Once German and then Jewish, the neighborhood was old before World War II, and it had not improved with age. Hillside Terrace, the city's first low-income housing project, offered some relief, but progress on the housing front was painfully slow. The newcomers also faced a sometimes hostile reception from older Milwaukeeans. Like the Yankees of the mid-1800s, many European ethnics struggled to accept the changing complexion of their city. As African Americans pushed into old German sections of the North Side, they met both resistance and resentment. White flight was a common response. In the 1960s and 70s, it was not unusual for a neighborhood to swing from 90% white to 90% black in a single decade.
Conditions weren't much different in other northern cities, but three factors magnified Milwaukee's problems: the black community's late start, its rapid growth, and the entrenched attitudes of many whites. Milwaukee changed from a comfortably European city to a multicolored community in little more than 20 years. But how much had the city changed essentially? If other Milwaukeeans had tried harder to see the me in thee, they would have realized that most African Americans wanted just what they did: safe streets, solid homes, and sound futures for their children.
New leaders emerged to bring that message home with unmistakable clarity. In 1956, Vel Phillips became the first African American and the first woman on Milwaukee's Common Council. She led a long and frustrating fight for an open housing ordinance that met stubborn opposition at every turn.
I did try to, as I said, to appeal to a sense of justice, but it's quite apparent to me that the members of this honorable body, these cats are just too dumb to know when they have something going for them. It's bad enough to have to deal with a bigot, but when you got a dumb bigot,
local issues mirrored national concerns. As the civil rights movement gathered momentum in the South, it created new dreams, new leaders, and new tensions throughout the country, including Milwaukee. Education was one of the first flashpoints. In the early 1960s, an interracial parents group charged that Milwaukee's public schools were intentionally and illegally segregated. Their leader was Lloyd Barbie, a Memphis-born, Wisconsin-educated lawyer and state legislator. He argued that by limiting students' contacts with other races, the system denied both black and white children an equal education. Barbie and his fellow activists formed a group called MUSIC, the Milwaukeeans United for School Integration Committee. MUSIC organized demonstrations, boycotts, and a network of freedom schools to make public officials change their tune. The MUSIC protests marked the debut of one of the most unlikely civil rights leaders in America, Father James Grappi. A product of Bayview's Italian community, Grappi was a young priest serving a Northside parish at the time. After a 1965 trip to the front lines in Selma, Alabama, he embraced the African American quest for freedom as his own, becoming advisor to the NAACP Youth Council.
We're going to exercise our constitutional right to picket and to protest. We have tried every means possible to bring fair housing legislation to the city of Milwaukee. And we're going to continue to march. It's up to the government of this city and of this state to see to it that we can exercise our constitutional right of freedom of speech. And we're going to exercise that, regardless of what the danger. We'll die for that right.
Grappi and the council led a series of highly visible demonstrations, first against a whites-only private club, and then against segregated housing. When the demonstrators targeted a working-class white section of the South Side, the response was particularly hateful. The open housing marches continued for months, bringing Grappi and Milwaukee national prominence.
What I can't understand is, where is the leadership in the white community? Well, for heaven's sake, apparently there isn't any leadership in the white community, because those people are going to church every Sunday, and I can't understand how they can go to church where they're supposed to be learning the doctrine of Jesus Christ, which is love and brotherhood, and then come out there and call people niggers and black bastards, wave that Confederate flag and chant, "We want slaves," and everything else.
Throughout the 1960s, the spirit of nonviolent protest clashed with a mood of red-hot rage in America's inner cities. Violence had its day in the last half of the decade. In 1967 alone, there were 164 separate disturbances. Milwaukee's turn came on the night of July 30th, 1967. The riot began on the corner of North Avenue and King Drive, then North 3rd Street. It began like all the others. Someone threw a brick through a store window, and soon, chaos reigned. Fires, looting, gunshots, and sirens broke the customary Sunday night silence. As events spun out of control, the National Guard was called. It was not until 3 a.m. that the streets were quiet again, and tensions remained high for days. The final toll, three deaths, nearly 100 injuries, and 1,740 arrests.
The general area of the disorder was from State Street to Burleigh, and from First Street to Fifth Street. So, accordingly, Chief Breyer has sealed off that area.
The police department is taking all necessary precautions. The National Guard will remain on duty as long as necessary. And if we should need more help, we will get it. So remain in your homes during the curfew hours, and please ignore loose talk, which in itself can incite new discord.
The 1967 riot was a civic tragedy, but other cities experienced far worse violence. What set Milwaukee apart was the speed and scale of the official response. Mayor Henry Meyer and Police Chief Harold Breyer locked down the entire city, banning traffic, closing bars, and barricading freeways. Their actions certainly checked the spread of violence, but they also magnified the impact of the disturbance. Residents of the entire metropolis felt they were under siege, and high levels of fear were still evident months later.
Henry Meyer's firm response earned him a landslide victory in the next election, but there were no real winners in 1967. The riot was a conflict without resolution. The inner city's problems remained, white flight continued, and the gap between the races widened. In a long view of local history, the 1967 riot was a distant echo of the 8-hour protests of 1886. Not since the Bayview tragedy had there been such deadly chaos in the streets. In both cases, Milwaukeeans cheered the victory of law and order, but they were also horrified by the violence. The trauma faded, just like these murals from the 60s, but there remained a deep uneasiness about life in a city divided.
The 1967 riot was a dramatic sign of dissatisfaction with the status quo, but it was hardly the only one. Latinos, Native Americans, and other minority groups rose up to demand their full share of the American dream. Other people turned their backs on that dream. Young whites rejected their middle-class roots, at least temporarily, and developed a full-fledged counterculture. Its inward-looking dimension was obvious. 1967, the worst summer of urban unrest, was known in other circles as the summer of love. But the young people looked outward as well, usually with rage against the Vietnam War. In 1968, a group of protesters dubbed the Milwaukee 14 earned notoriety and jail time for burning draft records in a small downtown park. Five of the 14 were Catholic priests.
Jesus, our His Son, our friend and our God, in union with the Holy Spirit, the Spirit that joins the Father and the Son together. And may He join us and keep us strong always and always. Amen.
Amen.
A distinct women's movement emerged from the shadow of the larger crusade. A local chapter of the National Organization for Women formed in 1967, and its members were soon leading protests against beauty contests, bridal fairs, and men-only restaurant facilities. Some old traditions were obviously under fire, including the very idea of progress. Freeways, for instance, had long been viewed as vital to Milwaukee's future. By the late 1960s, they were increasingly seen as a form of urban suicide. Protesters succeeded in halting freeway projects that were still underway, including, most famously, the Dan Hoan Bridge. Until the harbor span was connected to surface streets in 1977, it was widely known as the Bridge to Nowhere.
There were times in the 1960s and 70s when it seemed the wheels were about to fall off. Protest rallies and racial tensions filled the news night after night. In the process, Milwaukee lost its civic innocence. For years, said Henry Meyer, Milwaukee had regarded herself somewhat complacently as more fortunate than her sister cities. The events of the 1960s exploded that illusion forever.
¶¶
the recent past is rough terrain for historians. There are no signposts, no landmarks. You find yourself in a dense thicket of facts and events, unable to see the forest for all the trees. But some things are still clear. Milwaukee has changed enormously in the recent past. Those changes have produced the usual mix of darkness and light, good news and bad. They began with the ferment of the 60s, and they continue today in your lifetime and mine.
Milwaukee was busier than a three-ring circus in the 60s. So much was going on that no one could take it all in at once. But the 60s brought more than struggle and strife. Milwaukee, as always, made time for celebrations. The Great Circus Parade rolled off to its first start in 1963. It was a summertime staple for decades in all its colossal, stupendous, magnificent glory. And there were other reasons to smile. The musical extravaganza called Summerfest made its debut in 1968, only a year after the city was nearly shut down by a riot. Summerfest's lakefront site had been the home of the Midsummer Festival in the 1930s and a Nike anti-aircraft missile battery in the 1950s. Growing with its audience, Summerfest became the largest outdoor music festival in America, drawing as many as 1 million people each year.
How you feel?
Henry Meyer, the father of Summerfest, put the celebration in context. Truly, he said, in these days of struggles against blight, prejudice, and poverty, it is a pleasure to have at least one goal which involves joy. The mayor even wrote a song for the event, the Summerfest Polka. Milwaukee was a happy place for professional sports as well. The Milwaukee Bucks came to town in 1968. 3 years later, riding the broad shoulders of a young giant named Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, they won the NBA championship. Baseball made a triumphant return in 1970, when the Seattle Pilots became the Milwaukee Brewers. The team seldom left the cellar in its early years. But stars like Robin Yount and Paul Molitor carried the Brewers to an American League pennant in 1982.
Milwaukee had plenty to cheer about after 1970, but there were broader patterns afoot. The ferment of the 60s produced a new perspective on urban life, a new way of looking at the city. Some things had been lost in the rush to the urban fringe, including a sense of history. Milwaukee rediscovered its roots after 1970, and its connection with the past was reborn.
The first sign of change was a new interest in old buildings. In 1968, the grand old Northwestern Railroad Depot on the lakefront was demolished. Never again, vowed a group of fledgling preservationists. From that day forward, any threat to Milwaukee's built heritage has been met with stiff resistance. Not every battle ended in victory, including the spectacular Plankinton Mansion, torn down, unannounced, early on a weekend morning. But many unique structures have been preserved to delight and inspire future generations. As historic buildings reclaimed their rightful place in the present, there was a renewal of interest in old neighborhoods. Suburban subdivisions, it turned out, weren't for everyone. Some people wanted neighborhoods with a stronger sense of place, a sense of the past, and a sense of community. They found those qualities in venerable neighborhoods like Bayview and Walker's Point, Sherman Park and Brewers Hill, Harambe, River West, and the Third Ward. At the same time, Milwaukeeans showed new interest in old ethnic traditions. Links to ancestral cultures were reestablished with a will after 1970. In the African-American community, clothing and hairstyles, art and literature all expressed a reborn sense of connection with the African motherland. In 1978, Milwaukee's Italians held a reunion on the Summerfest grounds near the heart of their old neighborhood and invited the general public. The result was Festa Italiana, Milwaukee's first lakefront ethnic festival. It was a runaway success, and soon other groups followed suit. Mexican, German, Polish, Irish, African American, Indian, Asian, and Arabian. 9 festivals emerged in all, and their combined attendance generally topped the 500,000 mark. The Holiday Folk Fair became the nation's largest indoor multi-ethnic festival, highlighting the culture, cuisine, and costumes of dozens of groups. No city in America could match Milwaukee's celebrations.
Milwaukee already had one of the richest ethnic stews in America, and it just kept getting richer. This used to be South 16th Street. Now it's Cesar Chavez Drive, named for the famous Mexican-American labor leader. Latinos spread south and west from Walker's Point after 1970. The new arrivals came to dominate Southside neighborhoods first settled by Polish immigrants, including my grandparents. They might be surprised to find tortillas in stores that once sold kielbasa.
The same pattern was apparent on the north side. Hundreds of African-American families surged north and west after 1970, following paths blazed by German Milwaukeeans. They found new homes on land that became part of the city in the 1950s. There were new groups as well, Hmong, Laotian, Vietnamese. They became Milwaukee's fastest growing ethnic groups after 1980. Exiled from war-torn homelands, these Southeast Asians built new lives in a city whose customs and climate could hardly be more different from the worlds they left behind. There has been no shortage of other newcomers. The result was world-class diversity, and Milwaukee celebrated that diversity with unusual spirit. It is through our diversity that we most fully realize our unity as a people.
Milwaukee's unity was too often more theoretical than real. As always, most newcomers settled in the city proper. Older groups, German, Polish, Irish, Italian, were still here by the thousands, but Milwaukee became a majority-minority city in the 1990s. Residents of European background were outnumbered by those with African, Latino, Asian, and Native roots.
The city's human riches did not translate to economic wealth. Milwaukee's minorities, new and old, usually occupied the lower rungs of the economic ladder. More affluent residents continued to sprawl outward into adjacent counties, and the gap between suburban haves and urban have-nots widened alarmingly. The gap was aggravated by an economic crisis. In the early 1980s, a savage recession ripped through America's manufacturing sector. Milwaukee, as a historic stronghold of manufacturing, suffered staggering losses. Alice Chalmers was the greatest casualty. 15,000 workers filled the West Allis complex at its peak, enough to populate a small city. But Alice Chalmers began to bleed red ink in 1981 and finally went bankrupt 6 years later.
When the workers left, factory buildings came down to make way for this strip mall, and the last erecting shop was converted to retail space. An old overhead crane still lingers like a ghost from a vanished time.
Alice Chalmers, unfortunately, was not alone. Schlitz, the beer that made Milwaukee famous, shut down in 1982. Pabst followed, though not until 1996. Miller and a handful of small brewers were left to keep up Milwaukee's reputation as a beer capital. The story was the same everywhere. Between 1979 and 1983, Milwaukee lost more than a quarter of its industrial jobs. Most did not return. African-American workers were hit especially hard. After years of struggle, they had finally moved into families supporting factory jobs. When plants closed, they suffered a disproportionate share of the losses. The result was a sharp increase in African American poverty, even as the larger economy recovered. When the economy finally bounced back, it was obvious that manufacturing was no longer the only game in town. New leaders made Milwaukee a national center for commercial printing, medical imaging equipment, temporary help, department stores, and data processing for banks. Some old giants continued to prosper, and manufacturing remained vitally important. Traditional companies embraced new technologies, and some old-line metal vendors roared to new heights in a new century.
Perhaps the clearest sign of Milwaukee's shift is here on the south side. This building was once the home of the Heil Company, a leading manufacturer of truck bodies. When Heil moved to Tennessee, Aurora Healthcare opened its headquarters here. Aurora has since replaced Ellis Chalmers as the region's largest private employer. Milwaukee's economy remains diverse, but the shift from manufacturing to service jobs is unmistakable.
Change was just as dramatic in the political arena. At City Hall, the Henry Meyer era came to an end in 1988, after 28 years. Meyer's successor was John Norquist, a Presbyterian minister's son. Norquist soon established himself as a fiscal conservative in the old Milwaukee tradition. But the mayor also showed an intense interest in urban design. He encouraged the development of a pedestrian-friendly, visually interesting city. Norquist's influence waned after he admitted an affair with a female staff member. The mayor stepped down in 2004, after nearly 16 years in office. Voters chose Tom Barrett, a former congressman, to succeed Norquist. The new mayor was an affable, energetic Irishman who helped restore a sense of calm to city politics. Milwaukee County government was considerably more volatile. In 1988, veteran Bill O'Donnell lost the county executive seat to newcomer Dave Schultz. Schultz left after a single term, and he was followed by Tom Ament, another courthouse insider. A flap over unusually generous pension benefits led to Ament's resignation and the recall of several board members. In 2002, voters made Scott Walker the first Republican ever to hold the executive's office.
As the political landscape changed, so did the physical landscape. The heart of the city came alive again, thanks to a renaissance shaped by city, county, and private efforts. That spirit of renewal debuted here at the Grand Avenue Mall, a project of the Meyer era.
The mall, known today as the Shops of Grand Avenue, opened with a flourish in 1982, and it became the catalyst for well over $1 billion in new development. Water Street blossomed as a center of nightlife. A theater district took shape in the shadow of City Hall. The historic Third Ward sprouted new galleries, restaurants, and condominiums. The Midwest Airlines Center gave both Milwaukeeans and convention goers a new place to gather. The downtown riverfront was reborn. The Park East Freeway corridor was cleared for redevelopment. A striking new bridge opened the Menominee Valley to a future that included recreation as well as industry. Downtown became a place to live again, and the city's center began to feel like a neighborhood for the first time in half a century. Two more landmarks broke new ground: Miller Park and the Art Museum's Calatrava edition. The Art Museum and the ballpark mark a community that, after all these years, is still open to the future, still spreading its wings to tomorrow.
Our journey ends at almost yesterday. We've been traveling through time in this series, following Milwaukee from its first faint stirrings to the complex metropolis of today. There's a vital link between past and present. History tells us how we got here. The story of our past explains the present. and shapes our common future.
From the very beginning, Milwaukee developed a story entirely its own, one that captured all the richness of the larger human drama. It has been a story punctuated by turmoil and tension, but by triumph as well. A story filled with colorful characters, some who took ethical shortcuts, and others who were civic saints. It has been a story of the constant struggle to make a living, and, more important, to make a life. Look into the faces of the ones who came before. Gaze deeply into their eyes. Eyes that stare back from the far side of forever. What passes between you? What message do they send from their eternal stillness? We are not so different after all. We are connected, each to each, across the constantly shifting borders of time. We're all in the same family album. The faces change as the pages turn, but it's all one story, the human condition in its endless depth and complexity. And the story continues. We each take our place on the page, linked to all that's gone before. We wake each day to a world of infinite possibility and write with our lives the next chapter.
Production of The Making of Milwaukee is made possible with grants from Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Halbert and Alice Kadish Fund, Paddock Fund, Lidke Smith Fund, Otto Borchard Family Fund, Catherine and Walter Lindsay Fund, Lined and Harry Bradley Foundation, Kepin Gerlach Foundation, Faye Macbeth Foundation, Northwestern Mutual Foundation, David and Julia Eline Charitable Foundation, We Energies, Joseph and Vera Zilber Foundation, Polyville Foundation, Douglas and Eleanor Seaman Trust, C.G. Schmidt, and by the MPTV Friends.